Imagine you're skating backward at roughly 20 miles per hour. Your heart rate is just absolutely spiking.
Oh yeah, lungs burning.
Exactly. Your lungs are burning from a 40-second shift, and your eyes are locked entirely downward on this tiny 3-inch disc of vulcanized rubber that you're trying to corral with a thin wooden stick.
Right, and your own shoulders and helmet are, blocking half your field of vision.
Yeah, and somewhere in your absolute blind spot, there is a 200-pound professional athlete closing in on you, completely intent on driving you straight through the fiberglass boards, and you cannot see him.
You can't hear him either. Not over the roar of 15,000 fans.
Right. So your physical survival, and really your team's tactical survival in that exact microsecond, depends entirely on a single word shouted by a teammate who's like 50 feet away.
It's the ultimate sensory deprivation scenario. I mean, it perfectly encapsulates the profound vulnerability of the sport.
It really does.
Because, we're conditioned to look at the player with the puck and think, oh, that is the commander of the play.
Yeah.
But the reality is the exact opposite.
Yeah, the player with the puck is, paradoxically, the absolute least informed person in the entire building.
Exactly.
Like, the fans see the threat, the coaches see it, but the information that could literally save that puck carrier from a catastrophic hit or save the team from a game-losing turnover is trapped silently inside a teammate's head.
And it costs absolutely nothing to acquire.
Nothing, but it's completely useless until it, crosses the threshold of their vocal cords.
Which fundamentally reframes what elite team chemistry actually is, right?
Okay.
We like to think of athletic success as something we can measure. Skating speed, shot velocity, lifting
The
strength.
measurable stuff, yeah.
Right. We look at a highlight reel of a blind behind-the-back pass right onto a teammate's tape, and we just call it hockey IQ or even telepathy.
Right, we assume these players just possess some like supernatural spatial awareness.
But when you actually break down the mechanics of a truly elite team, it isn't telepathy at all. It is just a relentless, unbroken chain of verbal data.
And that is the exact premise of our deep dive today. Welcome in. Because we are not just running through a glossary of hockey terminology here.
No, definitely not.
We are unpacking what might be the ultimate zero-cost hack for tactical dominance in, well, really any high-speed environment. Because a team that communicates constantly creates the illusion of being impossibly fast and highly skilled simply because they arrive at their decisions instantly.
The illusion of speed, yeah.
I like to think of that puck carrier as a fighter pilot, flying a jet through a narrow canyon while their onboard radar is completely jammed.
Oh, that's a great analogy.
They are entirely reliant on an AWACS, yes, an airborne warning and control system just circling above. In this scenario, their teammates are the AWACS, yes.
Right, because they have the bird's eye view, they can actually see the bodies approaching.
Exactly. And if the AWACS does not feed those coordinates to the pilot, that pilot is flying blind into the side of a mountain.
That analogy holds up perfectly when you look at the mechanics of a defensive zone retrieval. Because, I mean, a guess in your own zone is how you lose games.
100%.
When you're flying blind, the human brain defaults to panic. You guess. You blindly throw the puck up the boards, hoping a teammate is there, or you freeze.
You hold the puck a fraction of a second too long.
Right, and you get completely leveled. A single well-timed word from your AWACS converts that blind, panicked guess into a precise, informed, and safe decision.
So, for you listening right now, the goal of this conversation is mastery. By the time we are done, you're going to understand not just what words to shout on the ice, but the incredibly specific legal frameworks that govern them.
The rules matter so much here.
They do, and the actual physiological safety mechanics that dictate survival along the boards and the spatial geometries that make these calls work.
So let's start with the absolute foundation, right?
Let's do it.
Out of all the complex systems in the game, the source material identifies two specific words that carry the vast majority of the value.
Two words that cure the two biggest diseases of a puck retrieval, which are panic and blindness. The first word is time.
Yeah, time. It's arguably the most valuable single syllable in the sport, specifically because of what it does to a player's nervous system.
What do you mean by that?
Well, when a player skates back toward their own net to retrieve a dumped puck, their brain's threat detection system is firing on all cylinders. The default human instinct is to fear impending pressure.
Even if no one is there.
Exactly. Even if the nearest opponent is 40 feet away changing lines, the retrieving player's brain is screaming that a hit is imminent.
So that phantom pressure causes them to rush.
Right, to fumble the puck, to make a safe but tactically useless play instead of looking up and launching a constructive breakout.
It's just the ghost in the machine. They are reacting to a phantom threat.
But when the goaltender or defensive partner shouts, "Time," it acts as this immediate neurological pressure release valve.
I can picture the physical transformation on the ice. The receiver hears that word, their brain processes it in a fraction of a second, and their entire posture changes.
They glide for an extra beat.
Yeah, they lift their chin, they map out the opposing team's structure, and they transition from a mindset of survival into a mindset of attack.
Exactly. It just slows their internal clock down to match the reality of the external environment.
Yeah.
But, you know, then we have the mirror image of that scenario.
The warning siren.
Right. The cure for the blind turnover. And that is the call. Man on.
And this brings us to what I consider the absolute most critical takeaway of this entire discussion, the safety override.
Oh, absolutely.
When a player hears man on as they approach the boards, it is not merely tactical advice about an incoming forechecker. Yeah. It is a mandatory trigger for a non-negotiable physical posture.
This is an absolute life-saving safety rule. We really have to dig into the medical reality of this because the consequences of ignoring this posture are severe.
Yeah. The source material highlights research conducted by Dr. Charles Tater, right?
Mm.
Which fundamentally informed USA Hockey's safety protocols.
Right. When you are tracking a puck into the boards and you hear man on, there are two instinctual physical actions that you must forcefully train yourself never to do.
The first one is ducking. And the research here is absolutely fascinating, albeit terrifying.
It is terrifying.
When you are looking for a puck at your feet, the natural human reflex is to drop your head, to tuck your chin down towards your chest to see the ice. But from a physiological standpoint, doing that turns your spine into a time bomb.
Yeah, it's called cervical flexion. The human cervical spine, your neck, has a natural curve to it. It acts like a shock absorber.
Right.
When you take a hit with your head up, that natural curve allows the muscles and discs to absorb and dissipate the kinetic energy. But when you drop your chin to your chest, you straighten out that natural curve.
Your spine just aligns into a straight, rigid, segmented column.
A rigid rod of bone. And if you make head-on contact with the fiberglass boards or a goalpost while your cervical spine is straightened out like that,
it can't flex.
Right. That rod cannot flex. The kinetic energy of a 200-pound player driving into your back transfers straight down that rigid column, compressing the vertebrae directly into each other.
And Dr. Tater's research indicates that this precise mechanism, the head being slightly flexed during axial loading, is the primary cause of catastrophic, paralyzing on-ice spinal injuries.
Which is why the instruction is so absolute. You never duck.
Never.
The second prohibition is turning your back to the boards. Players often try to square their shoulders to the boards to use their own body as a shield, you know, to protect the puck from the incoming checker.
But doing so exposes your spine to a direct hit from behind.
Exactly. Even a relatively light shove from behind when you are positioned 2 or 3 feet from the board can violently snap your head forward or drive your crown directly into the glass.
Protecting a 6-ounce piece of vulcanized rubber can never, ever justify squaring your back to a human missile moving at 20 miles an hour.
Never.
So if we strip away the bad instincts, what is the exact physical mechanic of survival? Like, when I hear man on, what does my body actually do?
You immediately abandon the puck if necessary, and you get your skates parallel to the wall. You brace to take the incoming kinetic energy on the broad side of your body, your hip, your shoulder, and your forearm.
Head up.
Yes, your head is up, your chin is completely off your chest, and your eyes are forward. This alignment disperses the force of the collision across the strongest, most heavily padded parts of your body, entirely protecting your spinal column.
Okay, that makes complete sense for a high-speed collision. Uh-huh. But I want to introduce a wrinkle here that the source material brings up. What if you aren't flying toward the boards?
What do you mean?
What if you are tied up in a scrum or you're stationary and you lose sight of the puck entirely? Like it's directly underneath you, trapped in your skates. You can't see it, but your AOS's teammates can.
Ah, okay. That scenario triggers a highly specific command, feet or under.
Yeah.
This is a profound gift of information from your teammates.
Because a puck buried in your own skates is just a black hole. You know it's there, but you don't know exactly where.
Right. So when a teammate yells, feet, they're giving you a surgical instruction. Look down, locate the rubber, and use your skate blade to kick it up to your stick.
But hold on, I have to push back here.
Right.
We just spent 10 minutes establishing the absolute unbreakable rule of cervical flexion.
Mm.
Never drop your chin, never look down.
Right.
Now you're telling me there's a call designed specifically to make me look down.
It is a critical distinction, but it's based entirely on the context of the threat. Man-on implies that a high-speed, high-impact collision is imminent. You keep your head up to survive the blast.
Right, okay.
Feet, however, is utilized when you are already engaged in a low-speed battle. You are stationary against the boards, or the initial high-speed impact has already occurred, and you are now just grappling for position.
So the catastrophic danger of axial loading is heavily reduced in a static scrum.
Exactly. But the danger of the feet call isn't about your neck. It's about the blades on your boots. When you go digging for that puck, you must send your skate at the rubber, never at the man.
Because kicking in hockey is a legal minefield. The rule books have some of the most staggering discrepancies I have ever seen on this specific issue.
Oh, it gets complicated quickly.
Conceptually, kicking the puck is perfectly legal. NHL Rule 49.2, IIHF Rule 49.2, they all explicitly permit a player to kick the puck in all three zones. It's a standard play.
But the millisecond your skate blade makes contact with an opponent's body instead of the puck, you are in immense trouble.
The punitive measures for kicking a player are draconian, as they should be. Under NHL Rule 49.3, kicking an opponent, or even attempting to kick an opponent, carries an automatic match penalty.
It does not matter if the opponent is injured.
Right. It does not matter if they barely felt it. If the official determines there was a kicking motion directed at a player, you are immediately ejected from the game, and your team is severely penalized with a 5-minute major.
And USA Hockey and Hockey Canada apply a very similar, strict match penalty standard for kicking.
But the IIHF, which governs the Olympics, the World Championships, and all levels of UK hockey, they treat this slightly differently.
They do. The IIHF rulebook does not explicitly mandate a match penalty for kicking. Under IIHF Rule 49.3, the referee is given discretion.
Discretion on a kick.
Yeah, they can assess a major penalty, but if they do, an automatic game misconduct is attached. Functionally, it still ejects the offending player from the game, but it arrives at that punishment through a discretionary pathway rather than the NHL's automatic non-negotiable match penalty structure.
But the contrast that truly blew my mind in the source material comes from USA Hockey, which, you know, governs millions of amateur players, from youth leagues to adult rec leagues across the states.
The amateur rules are wild here.
Under USA Hockey rules, you do not even need to make a kicking motion to get thrown out of the building.
That is USA Hockey Rule 627A. And it fundamentally changes how a player must operate in a scrum.
Explain that one.
If an amateur player uses their skate blade to simply push off an opponent's skate, meaning there is no violent kicking motion, they just press their boot against the opponent's boot to gain physical leverage to reach the puck.
Wait, really? Just a push?
Yes, just a push. That act alone is assessed as a major penalty plus a game misconduct.
That is wild to think about. You are in a scrum, you hear feet, you look down, and to reach the puck, you just gently brace your steel against the other guy's steel, and suddenly you're ejected from the game.
It forces players to have absolute surgical precision with their blades. You're looking down, finding the rubber, and transitioning it to your stick while ensuring your feet remain completely isolated from the opponent's body.
It demands immense physical discipline in a highly chaotic, adrenaline-fueled environment.
Absolutely.
This feels like a perfect moment to anchor what we've covered so far. For you listening, if you are visualizing this game, think of the absolute physical discipline required.
Right. When you hear man on, your skates go parallel, your hip and forearm brace for impact, and your head stays up to protect your spine.
And when you hear feet in a scrum, you look down, but your blades seek only the puck, never the opponent, because the rule books will show absolutely no mercy for skate-on-skate contact.
That's the perfect summary.
And now let's assume our player has executed this flawlessly. They survived the physical pressure, they absorbed the hit, they found the puck, and it is safely on their stick. This transitions us from the realm of individual physical safety into the geography of spatial strategy.
Right. Where do they put the puck?
Exactly. Where does it go?
This introduces a new category of communication, directional commands. Words like over, up, reverse, rim, D to D, and chip.
And these are not merely suggestions, right?
No, they're obligations.
Yeah.
When an AWOX teammate shouts one of these commands, they're taking responsibility for the next phase of the play.
Then you better be right.
Exactly. You only shout a directional command if you genuinely have the spatial awareness to see the open ice, and you must be physically prepared to receive the puck if you are calling for it.
Let's clearly define the geography of these calls. Up is pushing the puck vertically up the strong side boards, usually hitting a winger who is waiting on the wall to break out.
Right.
D to D is a horizontal pass across the ice to your defensive partner. A chip is a nuanced, soft little lob pass into an open patch of ice for a teammate to skate into, bypassing a defender.
Pretty straightforward.
But the concepts I really want to dissect are the rim and the reverse, because on paper, they sound like the exact same action putting the puck onto the boards, but tactically, they are complete opposites.
Understanding the distinction between a rim and a reverse is really the hallmark of an elite defense corps.
How so?
Well, a rim is an aggressive action that goes with the flow of play. You fire the puck hard and high along the curve of the glass, sending it onward in the direction you are already moving.
Okay, and the reverse?
A reverse, as the name implies, sends the puck back the way you came, directly against the flow of play, bouncing it off the boards behind you.
So let's put the listener on the ice to visualize this. You are a defenseman. You're skating hard into your own corner to retrieve a loose puck. You look over your shoulder and you see a massive forechecker chasing you down.
Right.
How does your brain or your teammate's voice decide whether to rim it or reverse it?
It is entirely dictated by the momentum and the vector of that incoming forechecker. It is essentially applied physics.
Okay, walk me through the physics.
A rim is the solution when a forechecker is trying to seal you against the boards. They are taking a direct angle, attempting to pin your body and stop your forward progress. To defeat that seal, you use a rim to blast the puck past them along the glass, maintaining the forward momentum of the play.
Right, you are just bypassing their blockade entirely.
Correct. But a reverse is the solution for a forechecker who has miscalculated their speed. They are coming in way too hot, trying to deliver a massive hit, and they have overcommitted to their angle.
They can't stop.
Right. They possess too much forward momentum to stop. So you hit the brakes,
yep.
Absorb the glancing blow, and reverse the puck backward into the exact pocket of empty ice they just aggressively vacated.
It is exactly like judo. You are using their own aggressive momentum as a weapon against them. If they try to seal you, you rim it past them. If they overrun you, you reverse it behind them.
Exactly like judo.
Oh, but there's a massive caveat to the rim that the source material points out. A rim only works if it is executed with violence.
It must be hard, and it must be high on the glass. The glass is smooth and predictable. The yellow dashboard at the bottom of the wall is sticky and full of friction.
So if you go low...
If you send a soft rim along the bottom of the boards, the friction slows it down, allowing a secondary forechecker to pinch down and intercept it. As the material elegantly states, a soft rim is just a turnover with extra steps.
A turnover with extra steps. That is incredibly vivid. Now, when we talk about routing the puck around our own defensive zone, whether by rim, reverse, or passing D to D, there is one piece of real estate that we have to discuss, an absolute geographic danger zone that every player must treat like an active minefield.
The slot. Geographically, the slot is the narrow rectangular corridor of ice running straight down the middle of the defensive zone.
So between the circles.
Right. It spans the width between the inner edges of the two faceoff circles, stretching from the high hash marks down to the absolute front of the goaltender's crease. It is not painted red on the ice, but every defenseman must see it glowing red in their mind's eye.
So if I am pinned on the left wall and my defensive partner on the right wall yells over or D to D, begging for a horizontal pass to relieve the pressure.
You never, under any circumstance, route the pass through the slot. That is the universal prohibition of defensive zone hockey.
Period.
Period. If you attempt a horizontal D to D pass across the front of your own net and it lacks pace or gets bobbled, an opposing forward standing in the slot can intercept it.
And then it's just over.
You have instantly manufactured a point-blank high-danger scoring chance for the enemy. It is the most severely punished error a defenseman can make.
I am going to push back on this universal prohibition for a second because I watch a lot of NHL hockey, and I frequently see defensemen making horizontal passes to each other in their own zone.
Sure.
So if the slot is this terrifying kill zone, why do I see teams passing back and forth across the middle?
That observation highlights the crucial difference between a hard rule and a team convention.
Yeah.
The hard rule remains, do not pass through the slot, which is the area directly in front of the net.
Okay.
But how a team chooses to route the puck around the slot to achieve that horizontal transfer is a matter of tactical convention. The traditional safest route is to pass the puck deep behind the net, utilizing the area below the red goal line.
Because the net acts as a physical shield against interceptions.
Precisely. The opponent can't shoot through the back of the net. However, modern systems often employ a high road convention. The defenseman will exchange the puck high up in the zone, near the blue line, far above the tops of the face-off circles. They are crossing the middle of the ice, but they are doing it geographically above the slot.
Ah, I see the logic. If a pass is intercepted behind the net, it's harmless. If a pass is intercepted way up high at the blue line, it might result in a breakaway against you, which is bad, but it gives the goalie time to react.
Right.
But if a pass is intercepted in the slot, the puck is in the back of your net before the goalie even registers the turnover.
Exactly. The route behind the net and the road high at the blue line are both valid systemic choices. But cutting the geometry in half and passing straight across the goaltender's face, that is universally prohibited.
Okay, so we have the mechanics of survival, and we have the geography of safe passing. But what happens when the AOOACS radar goes completely blank?
The panic moments.
Yeah, what happens when there is no safe pass high, there is no safe pass low, and the forecheck is swarming you like bees? You are trapped, your lungs are burning, and a teammate screams off the glass, or ice it.
Right. We are moving out of the realm of strategy and into desperation and clearances. And the legal cost of these desperation plays is fascinating.
It really is.
This is where raw situational awareness must perfectly intersect with a deep technical understanding of the rulebook. Let's examine the glass call.
Okay.
You are under immense suffocating pressure in your defensive zone. You have no passing options. You make the desperate decision to just flip the puck high into the air, off the glass, to clear the zone and live to fight another day.
It seems like the safest, most logical panic button you could hit.
It is, right up until you elevate the puck an inch too high and it sails over the glass into the spectator netting.
And then?
Under both NHL and IIHF rules, shooting the puck directly out of play from your defensive zone is a strict liability penalty for delay of game. It results in an automatic 2-minute minor.
They don't care about intent at all.
The referee does not care about your intent.
Right.
There is no exception for being under extreme pressure. If the puck goes over the glass, you go to the penalty box.
And this brings us to one of the most pervasive, widely believed myths in all of hockey, the bench exemption.
Oh, this one is everywhere.
Every kid growing up playing the game has heard some coach say, if you are going to panic and shoot it out, aim for the player's benches. If it lands in the bench, it's not a penalty because there's no glass there.
It is an incredibly dangerous myth to rely on in a professional or international game, and the IIHF Situation Handbook completely dismantles the geometry of this myth.
Let's look closely at that. IIHF Situation 63.24.
Imagine a defender is pinned near the corner. They shovel the puck high off the glass. It arcs upward, completely clears the top edge of the glass, goes out of the playing area, but its downward trajectory causes it to land safely amidst the players sitting on the bench.
The crowd sees it land in the bench.
Does the player get a penalty?
Based on the myth, they should be safe. But the answer is a resounding yes. They are getting a penalty.
Yes, they are. Because the rule book does not care where the puck physically lands. The handbook requires the officials to visualize an imaginary infinite vertical plane extending straight up to the arena roof from the top edge of the glass.
An imaginary plane.
If the puck breaks that imaginary plane at any point during its flight, it has officially left the playing area. The penalty is triggered the millisecond. It crosses that invisible boundary in the air, regardless of whether gravity eventually drops it into the bench.
That is such a vivid geometric concept, the imaginary infinite plane. So the only physical way to actually achieve a legal bench clearance is if you shoot the puck at a perfectly flat trajectory.
Straight through the open doorway.
Yeah, straight through the gap between the glass partitions, directly into the bench area without it ever rising above the height of the glass.
Correct. And aiming a flat, laser-precise shot through a 3-foot gap while a forechecker is cross-checking you in the spine, it requires a level of mechanical precision that a panicking player simply does not possess.
It's a terrible gamble.
It is. Now, it is important to note that this strict liability imaginary plane rule belongs to the NHL and the IIHF. The landscape changes massively when we look at amateur USA Hockey rules.
Right. USA Hockey does not utilize that strict liability limb for clearances. Under USA Hockey Rule 631 to LED, an accidental shootout during the flow of play is simply treated as a stoppage.
The referee blows the whistle, drops the puck for a face-off, and play resumes.
Exactly. They only penalize shootouts that are visibly and undeniably deliberate. So if you just whiff on a clearance and it helicopters into the netting, you aren't going to the box.
However, while USA Hockey is significantly more forgiving of an accidental mechanical failure during live play, they are remarkably draconian regarding intentional acts of frustration after the whistle has blown.
Oh yeah, the dead puck stuff.
Let us say the goaltender freezes the puck, the whistle blows, and a frustrated defender intentionally slaps the puck over the glass. Under NHL and IIHF rules, that petulant act is still just a standard 2-minute minor penalty.
But USA Hockey drops the hammer here. Under USA Hockey Rule 601(c)(10), a deliberate shootout after the whistle escalates immediately to a 10-minute misconduct penalty.
Wow.
And if the referee determines you shot the puck out of the rink specifically to protest an official's decision, it escalates to a game misconduct, you are thrown out of the building.
The philosophy is vastly different. The pro leagues punish the mechanical error of delaying the game.
Yeah.
The amateur league punishes the behavioral intent.
Okay, so that maps out the profound risk of the glass call. Let's look at the other desperation button, ice it.
Right.
When a teammate screams ice it, they are telling you to just fire the puck 200 feet down the length of the rink.
The true strategic cost of the ice it command depends entirely on the numerical context of the game at that exact moment.
Break that down.
If your team is shorthanded, meaning you have a player in the penalty box and you are killing a penalty icing, the puck is a perfectly legal, highly encouraged, and brilliant tactical strategy to relieve pressure and bleed the clock.
But if you are playing 5-on-5 at even strength, icing the puck is an incredibly expensive panic button.
It is a devastating physical trap. When you ice the puck at even strength, the play is blown dead and the faceoff is dragged all the way back to your own defensive zone.
And then the trap springs.
But crucially, under both NHL and IIHF rules, the team that committed the icing infraction is strictly banned from substituting their players. Your line cannot change. Mm. Furthermore, your coach is explicitly prohibited from using their timeout to rest you.
I want to really emphasize the physiological cruelty of this rule.
It's brutal.
Picture being that defenseman. You just fought through a grueling, lung-burning 45-second shift. You're trapped in your own end, chasing the puck, absorbing hits. Lactic acid is flooding your legs. You are gasping for air. You finally get a stick on the puck, and in sheer desperation, you ice it. The whistle blows. You skate toward the bench for salvation, and the referee points directly at you and says, "No, stay out there."
You have to stay out there.
You have to take a defensive zone faceoff against a brand new, fully rested offensive line while your heart rate is at 190 beats per minute.
It is punishing. And naturally, teams constantly try to find loopholes to sneak their exhausted players off the ice. But the rulebooks have anticipated this. The exceptions to the substitution ban are incredibly narrow.
What are they?
NHL Rule 81.4 only permits a change in 3 highly specific scenarios. If a goalie was pulled for an extra attacker and needs to return, if a penalty is called on the play that alters the on-ice numerical strength, or if a player is genuinely visibly injured.
I'm exhausted is not a legally recognized exception.
Definitely not.
But this leads us to one of my absolute favorite quirks from the source material. You found a bizarre, contradictory loophole in the international rulebook regarding a broken skate, didn't you? Let's unpack how a rulebook can actually glitch.
It is a fascinating editorial contradiction in the IIHF rulebook. As we noted, the rules are highly restrictive. But the IIHF actually writes the icing substitution ban into their manual twice in consecutive sections.
Okay.
In Rule 81.4, they list the exceptions to the icing ban, and they add a 4th exception that does not exist in the NHL. They state that a substitution is allowed for a player with a broken skate.
Okay, logically that makes sense. If my skate blade snaps in half after I ice the puck, I am a physical hazard to myself and others. I can't stand up. So Rule 81.4 says I can crawl to the bench and get replaced.
You would certainly.
Oh, don't test it.
Do not send a replacement player over the boards hoping the referee has memorized Rule 81.4 instead of Rule 82.1. Because under IIHF Rule 82.2V, if the referee deems it an illegal substitution attempt, they will send the replacement back to the bench and issue a formal warning to the coach.
Just a warning.
You only get 1 warning per game. If you attempt any illegal change again, your team is hit with a bench minor penalty for delay of game.
Mm-hmm.
You are going on the penalty kill because you tried to exploit a typo.
Which ties perfectly back into why communication is the ultimate hack. Knowing when to shout ice it requires an AYQC teammate who recognizes not just the immediate danger of the puck, but the physical reality of their teammates.
Right. You only yell ice it if you know the 5 guys on the ice have enough remaining cardiovascular endurance to survive the ensuing defensive zone faceoff, because you know the rule book will not allow your coach to save you.
So if we tie this first half of the discussion together, the theme is absolute precision. When you hear man on, Your posture is parallel, your head is up, and you brace. When you move the puck, you avoid the slot like a plague.
Right.
And when you panic, you don't aim for the glass thinking the bench will grant you immunity because the imaginary vertical plane will send you straight to the penalty box.
And you don't ice it unless you can survive the next shift.
Exactly. Now, we need to pivot. We have spent this entire time talking about how to survive when your team has the puck. But what happens when the opponent has the puck in your zone and you are scrambling to defend? We are entering the realm of invisible battles.
This requires us to look at how visual misdirection causes defensive breakdowns. Let's paint the picture of a classic defensive scramble.
Okay, set the scene.
The opposing team dumps the puck into your corner. A massive physical battle ensues. You have a defenseman and a forechecker aggressively pinning each other against the glass, hacking at the puck with their skates. Where are the eyes of the other 8 skaters on the ice?
Human nature dictates that everyone is staring at the puck. It's the most exciting thing happening. The battle in the corner is loud, it's physical, it draws all the attention.
And that biological instinct to watch the conflict is exactly how goals are scored. When the defending players get puck focus and watch the corner, they lose all spatial awareness of the two most geographically dangerous areas on the ice.
Which are?
The first is the high slot, which we discussed. The second is the back door, the weak side far goal post, away from the puck.
It's a magic trick. The scrum in the corner is the loud distraction waving its hands, while the silent assassin is the opposing forward creeping quietly down the weak side of the ice, completely unmarked, waiting by the back door for a cross-ice pass.
Exactly.
So what are the vocal commands that break that hypnosis?
The first is simply the call, back door. When a goaltender or a high forward recognizes that an opponent is sneaking into that weak side space, they scream that command.
And what does that command require?
That word demands that the nearest defending player must instantly abandon their current zonal assignment, break their visual lock on the puck, and physically engage that unmarked opponent. And then there is the second critical command, which comes from the goalie, scream.
The screener? The opposing player whose sole job is to park their large body directly in front of the goaltender's eyes, blinding them to the shot.
Oh, worse.
When the goalie yells, "Screen!" Your job as a defenseman is to physically obliterate that visual blockade. You have to move that massive human being out of the way. But I want to introduce an analogy here. Moving a screener legally is exactly like defusing a live bomb.
I think that is a highly accurate way to frame the physical delicacy required.
Right. If you are defusing a bomb, you have the blast zone, which in this case is the blue paint of the goal crease. You have the trigger wire, which is the opponent's stick. And you have an array of brightly colored wires you can cut. If you cut the exact right wire with surgical precision, you neutralize the threat. But if your hand shakes and you cut the wrong wire, you don't just fail to clue the screen. The bomb detonates, the referee's arm goes up, and you get ejected from the game.
The penalty box calls.
So walk me through the biomechanics of illegal defusal, step by step. How do I move this player without triggering the bomb?
The first step is establishing dominant body position. You must box the screener out using your hips and your lower back. Very similar to a basketball player fighting for a rebound under the hoop.
Just claiming the space?
Right. The legal foundation here is that 3 of the 4 major rule books, the NHL, the IIHF, and USA Hockey, explicitly state that a player is entitled to the ice they're currently standing on. Therefore, claiming that adjacent space with your hips and physically leaning into them is a completely legal hockey play.
Okay, so I've backed my hips into them. I'm legally occupying their space. But they're still standing there, and their stick is still on the ice, ready to deflect a shot. I need to neutralize that stick. How do I tie it up legally?
This is where you must cut the exact right wire. You must slide the blade of your stick under the shaft of their stick, and you must lift it below their bottom hand.
Below the bottom hand.
That is the precise location. If you engage their stick low on the shaft, near the blade, you can legally lever it up into the air, rendering them incapable of deflecting a puck. But if you lift your stick too high, or you chop down at their stick at or near their hands, you are entering a world of severe game-ending penalties.
Let's map out the explosions. Let's go through the rulebook consequences of cutting the wrong wires. What happens if I get impatient and instead of lifting from the bottom, I just aggressively chop down on their gloves to knock the stick out of their hands?
That constitutes slashing. And the rulebooks are remarkably unified in their intolerance for this. Under all 4 major codes, NHL, IIHF, USA Hockey, and Hockey Canada, a forceful chop directed at the hands can result in a major penalty plus a game misconduct.
Even without an injury.
And crucially, This applies even if no injury occurs. The officials do not wait to see if a finger is broken. The violence of the act alone is enough to have you ejected from the game.
Okay, chopping the hands triggers an immediate explosion. I'm ejected. What if I bypass the stick entirely? What if I take the shaft of my own stick in two hands, place it horizontally across their lower back, and just aggressively shove them out of the crease?
A two-handed shove using the shaft of the stick is the textbook definition of a cross-checking penalty.
Yeah.
In the NHL, officials are explicitly mandated to heavily police the net front area for cross-checking.
It's a big point of emphasis.
Yeah. If the referee deems your shove severe enough to warrant a major penalty under NHL Rule 59.3, it carries an automatic, mandatory game misconduct. You are thrown out.
Wow. So I cannot chop the hands, and I cannot cross-check the back. What if I just rely on brute force? What if I drop my shoulder, use my body weight, and just bulldoze them out of the way with a heavy body check?
The legality of that entirely depends on the league you are playing in. If you are in the NHL, or a professional league that permits full body checking, utilizing your body weight to battle for position is generally acceptable.
But amateur leagues.
However, if you are playing in a non-checking environment, such as USA Hockey, U12 youth leagues, women's hockey, or non-check adult recreational leagues, walking a screener out with a forceful push is an illegal hit.
Under what rule?
Under USA Hockey Rule 604, deliberate physical contact in a non-checking league is a minor penalty. But if you push them violently into the goalpost and recklessly endanger them, that escalates to a major penalty plus a game misconduct.
This is a legal minefield. So the only completely safe, universally legal method to clear a screener across all rule books is box out low with the hips, slide your stick underneath theirs, and lift firmly below the bottom hand.
Exactly. But there is one more vital geometric detail regarding screeners that players often misunderstand. Screening a goaltender from outside the painted blue crease, assuming you are not making physical contact with the goalie, is an entirely legal act.
Wait, let me clarify that. If an opposing player is standing just a few inches outside the blue paint of the crease, perfectly obstructing the goalie's line of sight, the referees are not going to blow the whistle to help the goalie out.
No, they will not. The NHL and IIHF rules regarding goaltender interference require the attacking player to actually penetrate the three-dimensional space of the goal crease to void a goal.
So outside the paint is fair game.
If they're established outside the paint, they have every legal right to occupy that ice. It is entirely the responsibility of the defending team to physically move them.
And if they step inside.
Now, if the attacking player's body is physically inside the blue paint, the landscape shifts. Both the IIHF and USA Hockey have provisions allowing referees to blow the whistle and stop play if an attacking player is lingering inside the crease.
Do they all do that?
Though only USA Hockey treats it as a mandatory stoppage. The NHL and Hockey Canada do not even write a specific crease stoppage rule for live play. They simply utilize video review to disallow the goal after the puck goes in.
This entirely recontextualizes why the goalie is screaming screen. They aren't yelling at the referee to fix it. They know the referee won't save them if the guy is outside the paint.
No, they won't.
The goalie is yelling at the defenseman, demanding they execute a perfectly legal, high-stakes hip box out and low stick lift, because if the defenseman does it wrong, they are taking a slashing major. It really is high-stakes physical chess.
It absolutely is.
Which brings us to the most dynamic phase of the game, transition. We've defended our zone, we've cleared the screener, and now the puck is turning over. Let's look at rush defense, the nightmare scenario.
The two-on-one.
The opponent intercepts a pass at center ice and comes back at you with an odd man rush, specifically a two-on-one.
The two-on-one rush is the ultimate test of defensive communication. You have one lone defenseman skating backward, furiously trying to manage the gap. You have two highly skilled attackers flying at them at high speed. And you have the goaltender in the net behind the defenseman.
Chaos.
The geometry of this threat requires a rigid division of labor.
So, who is doing what? How do they coordinate a defensive strategy at 25 miles an hour?
The standard systemic approach is this. The defenseman's primary responsibility is to eliminate the passing lane to the second attacker. The goaltender's primary responsibility is to square up and stop the puck carrier if they shoot.
But how do they sync that up?
For this division of labor to function, the goaltender must dictate it vocally. The goalie will yell one word, shot.
And this right here is the massive paradigm shift. This is the aha moment of this entire conversation. When a goalie screams shot as a two-on-one bears down on them, they are not warning the defenseman that the puck carrier is winding up to shoot.
Correct. As a concept, a vocal warning in hockey is largely useless because it tells a skater nothing they can act on. It just induces flinching.
Right.
When a goaltender yells shot, they are making a declarative claim. They are claiming the shooter as their sole responsibility.
You're saying, I've got him.
They're communicating to the retreating defenseman. I have the puck carrier's angle locked down. I am creating this scenario exactly like a breakaway. I do not need your help with the shooter. Commit your entire body and stick to eliminating that pass.
That is so deeply counterintuitive to standard human instinct, but tactically, it is brilliant. If I am a defender and someone yells, shot, my natural biological instinct is to flinch, to turn my body toward the puck and try to throw myself in front of it to block it.
Which is exactly what the goalie doesn't want.
Right. The goalie is actually demanding the exact opposite. They are saying, do not try to block it. Do not turn your body. If you try to play the puck carrier, you will leave the passing lane open. The puck will slide across to the weak side and I will be hopelessly out of position for the one-timer.
Exactly.
By yelling shot, the goalie successfully splits a dangerous two-on-one into two manageable separate one-on-ones.
Precisely. If the defenseman knows with absolute certainty that the goaltender has claimed the shooter, the defenseman can keep their stick flat on the ice, maintain their speed, and entirely erase the backdoor threat.
Okay, so the defenseman takes the pass, the goalie takes the shooter, and let's say they make the save. The goalie deflects the puck to the corner, our winger picks it up, and we immediately transition to offense. We are flying up the ice.
Time for a stretch pass.
Yes. The winger sees a forward breaking deep into the offensive zone and yells, stretch! They want to throw that long bomb stretch pass. What is the rulebook nuance regarding offsides that dictates whether this pass works?
The stretch pass is an incredibly lethal weapon, but executing it requires the receiver to intimately understand the blue line physics dictated by their specific rulebook. The fundamental rule of offsides is universal. An attacking player cannot completely cross the offensive blue line before the puck does.
Right, but what about the physical mechanics of the skates? What if the player is straddling the line? Let's say their front skate is deep in the offensive zone and their back skate is trailing behind them.
Okay.
The back skate is physically hovering in the air directly over the blue line, but the steel is not touching the ice. Is that player onside?
This is where the major rule books completely fracture. If you are playing under NHL or IIHF rules, a skate hovering in the air over the blue line absolutely counts as being onside.
Oh, it does.
The rule is created as a three-dimensional vertical plane.
Mm-hmm.
As long as the plane of the blue line has not been completely broken by both skates, you are onside, regardless of whether the back skate is touching the ice or hovering a foot above it.
But what if I am playing amateur hockey in North America? Mm-hmm. What do USA Hockey and Hockey Canada say?
They reject the hovering skate entirely.
Mm.
Under USA Hockey Rule 630A and Hockey Canada Rule 6.11, maintaining an onside position explicitly requires physical skate contact with the ice on or behind the blue line.
Physical contact is mandatory.
If your back skate lifts off the ice by a single millimeter before the puck crosses the line, you are instantly ruled offside.
So if you are playing in a North American amateur league, you have to physically drag your back toe on the ice as you cross the line to receive that stretch pass. You cannot stride naturally and hover.
You have to drag it.
Knowing that minute biomechanical difference is the difference between a clean breakaway goal and a whistle that kills the play. Speaking of whistles and chaos, let's look at the most chaotic communication matrix of all, changing lines on the fly.
Total chaos.
You are gassed. You hear a coach yell, change, from the bench. A replacement player is ready to jump over the boards. How close do you physically have to be to the bench before they can legally jump on?
Unsurprisingly, the legal distance depends entirely on whose rulebook is governing the game. Under NHL and IIHF regulations, the window is clearly quantified. You are granted a 5-foot window, or exactly 1.5 meters in the IIHF manual.
Okay, 5 feet.
As long as the retiring player is within a 5-foot radius of the bench doors and is actively removing themselves from the play, the fresh player can step onto the ice.
5 feet is pretty tight. What does Hockey Canada allow?
Hockey Canada is significantly more generous. They grant a 10-foot window, or 3.05 meters. It allows for a much wider margin of error during sloppy line changes.
And USA Hockey, how many feet do they give?
USA Hockey provides no set measurement whatsoever.
Wait, really? No distance at all? Does that mean I can just jump onto the ice when my retiring teammate is coasting through center ice?
No, because USA Hockey replaces a hard measurement with a highly subjective situational standard.
Oh, okay.
The text states the retiring player must simply be at a player's bench and out of the play. However, USA Hockey introduces a subjective trigger for the officials. The referee will assess a bench minor penalty for too many men on the ice if the early change, quote, causes their team to gain a competitive advantage, even if neither player physically touches the puck.
That is fascinating. So the NHL relies on a hard 5-foot tape measure, whereas USA Hockey relies on a situational vibe check.
A vibe check, exactly.
If jumping over the boards early suddenly turns an opponent's 2-on-1 rush into a 2-on-2, the referee can blow the play dead because you gained a competitive advantage by breaking the distance rule even if the puck was 50 feet away.
Exactly right.
This brings us to a player we have referenced multiple times, but who requires their own dedicated analysis because they are the architect of everything we have discussed. The ultimate informant, the goaltender.
Goaltender must fundamentally be the loudest, most authoritative voice in the defensive zone. And the reasoning for this is not about leadership personality. It is purely anatomical and geometric.
How so?
They are the only player on the ice who is permanently facing the entire field of play. They are relatively stationary, meaning their brain is not bogged down by the intense physical load of high-speed skating. And geographically, there is absolutely nothing happening behind them.
It is the ultimate vantage point. The goalie is the A-way CS plane, in our fighter pilot analogy. They possess the exact visual data that the retreating defenseman lacks.
Exactly. When a defenseman is skating backward toward their own end boards to retrieve a dumped puck, their eyes are locked on the glass. They are completely, terrifyingly blind to the forecheck arriving behind their shoulders.
But the goalie sees it.
The goaltender is staring right at that forecheck. The real-time vocal transfer of that visual data from the goalie to the defenseman is the primary mechanism that prevents high-danger turnovers.
So the goalie is the one orchestrating the symphony. They are yelling, time, man on, over, up. But where can the goalie physically go to actually play the puck and aid in these breakouts? Because the rinks are painted with literal lines designed specifically to restrict a goaltender's mobility.
Yes, the infamous trapezoid. Under NHL and IIHF rules, there are distinct lines painted behind the net forming a trapezoid shape. This rule was implemented specifically to prevent highly skilled puck-handling goalies from acting as third defensemen and constantly neutralizing dump-ins.
So they have to stay inside it.
The rule dictates that the goalie may only play the puck behind the red goal line if the puck is physically inside that marked trapezoid area. If they play the puck behind the goal line, but outside the trapezoid, for example, if they skate deep into the corner, they are assessed a 2-minute minor penalty for delay of game.
And when a referee is determining if a goalie committed a trapezoid violation, what are they looking at? Are they measuring the position of the goalie's body or the position of the puck?
Under NHL and IIHF regulations, the penalty is determined exclusively by the position of the puck. A goalie can technically have both skates outside the trapezoid, but as long as their stick makes contact with a puck that is inside the painted lines, the play is legal.
Okay, but what if I am playing USA Hockey or Hockey Canada? I don't see a trapezoid painted on the ice at my local community rink.
That is because amateur North American hockey does not utilize the trapezoid rule. In USA Hockey and Hockey Canada, the goaltender enjoys significantly more freedom.
They can just roam.
They are essentially allowed to function as that third defenseman. They can roam deep into the corners and play the puck anywhere behind the goal line without restriction.
So they have total geographical freedom in the defensive zone.
Not total. There is a universal boundary that all four major rule books, NHL, IIHF, USA Hockey, and Hockey Canada, strictly enforce. A goaltender is absolutely prohibited from taking any deliberate part in the play beyond the center red line. They cannot cross mid-ice.
Right. The goalie cannot skate into the offensive zone and start running the power play. But let me push back on their freedom within their own zone. If I'm playing USA Hockey and there's no trapezoid keeping my goalie near the net, can I just tell my goalie to skate 15 feet out to the faceoff dot, fall on a loose puck, and freeze it just to get a whistle and relieve the pressure?
Absolutely not. This is a crucial distinction. While USA Hockey and Hockey Canada allow the goaltender to freely play and pass the puck, they heavily restrict the act of freezing the puck.
So they can't just jump on it anywhere.
Under USA Hockey Rule 614C, a goaltender is assessed a minor penalty for delay of game if they freeze a puck when their body is entirely outside the boundaries of the goal crease.
Oh, wow.
Hockey Canada's rule is even more draconian. Once a goaltender's body leaves the crease, They are forbidden from freezing the puck at all, and the officials are instructed not to issue a warning before calling the penalty.
Wow, okay. So they can pass it, they can shoot it, but they cannot smother it.
There is one vital exception to that rule. Both rule books permit a goaltender to freeze the puck outside the crease, only if they just made a save.
Ah, right, that makes sense.
It is completely legal for a goalie to challenge a shooter by coming out to the top of the faceoff circle, stopping a hard shot, and immediately covering the rebound. But if they're just skating out of the net to dive on a slow-moving loose puck that was never a shot on goal, they're getting a minor penalty.
That distinction is paramount. You never scream, "Freeze it," to a goalie who is 10 feet out of their crease chasing a dump-in. Knowing the specific legal limits of your goalie's mobility dictates exactly what commands you are allowed to give them.
Exactly.
This leads us perfectly into the final phase of our masterclass. We have spent an hour learning these incredibly complex legal frameworks, the spatial geometries of the rink, and the biomechanical safety rules. But how on earth does a team actually execute this in real time, on the ice, at 25 miles an hour, while exhausted? How do you build the habit?
It fundamentally comes down to understanding the physics of a vocal call. The source material outlines three golden rules for vocal communication in a high-speed environment. First, early beats accurate. Second, short beats specific. Third, loud beats clever.
Let's break those down individually. Early beats accurate. That sounds almost counterproductive. Why wouldn't I want my call to be perfectly accurate?
Because of human processing time. A slightly imperfect call that is delivered a full second before the puck arrives is infinitely more useful than a perfectly accurate, highly detailed call delivered as the puck arrives on the blade.
Because too late.
Exactly. The receiver's brain requires a fraction of a second to process the auditory information, map it to their spatial awareness, and form a physical muscular plan of action. If you wait until the puck touches their stick to tell them they have a man on, their body is already committed to a physical action, and the warning is useless.
That makes perfect sense. The information needs time to travel from the ear to the muscles. Rule 2, short beats specific.
If your vocal command requires a comma, it is too long. The phrase "man on" works precisely because it is two sharp percussive syllables.
Right.
If an AYCC's teammate tries to say, "Hey, there's a forechecker closing in fast over your left shoulder," that is entirely useless. By the time the speaker reaches the word "shoulder," the hit has already been delivered.
And the final rule, loud beats clever.
An ice rink is an incredibly hostile acoustic environment. You have the constant sound of steel skates carving into hard ice, composite sticks violently slapping rubber, the hum of the refrigeration system, the roar of the crowd, and you are wearing a plastic helmet with ear guards that heavily muffle sound.
It's deafening down there.
A beautifully articulated, highly tactical call delivered at conversational volume simply does not exist on the ice. If you do not project from your diaphragm, you are essentially mute.
And part of that projection is maintaining strict vocabulary discipline. One word must have one unalterable meaning. The source material points out a massive common trap that players fall into. The call behind you.
Behind you is a terribly ambiguous, dangerous call.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the context of a hockey game, it could mean there was an opposing player sneaking up behind you. Or it could just as easily mean you lost the puck in your skates and it is trailing on the ice behind you. In that split second, the receiver hears the words and has to consciously translate the context based on the current play.
And you just said processing time is everything.
Right. And as we establish, any call that requires cognitive translation is worse than silence, because it costs the receiver a crucial cognitive beat.
So what is the fix for ambiguity?
You assign one hyper-specific word per meaning. You strictly use "man on" for the physical threat. You strictly use "feet" or "under" for the lost puck. And crucially, you attach names to commands.
Oh, names.
Yes. Shouting "Sam, man on" triggers an immediate instinctual reaction from Sam. Shouting a generic "man on" into the void of the rink just causes four different teammates to nervously turn their heads and look confused.
Okay, so we have the verbal physics locked in. But there is one specific moment in a hockey game where the frantic action stops, the ambient noise drops, and the players can actually huddle and plan. Face-offs.
Ah, face-offs.
And this raises an incredibly important dynamic. Who runs the communication matrix before the puck drops?
The center must dictate the play. The center is the architect of the face-off. They must tell the other four skaters exactly what the set play is, who is blocking whom, and where the puck is going, all while the linesman is still skating in with the puck.
And there's a legal reason for this too, right?
Yes. The reason the center must be in absolute control of this communication goes far beyond just trying to win possession. It is deeply tied to the punitive nature of the rulebook.
Right. The face-off encroachment rule. We have to explain the mechanics of this because it is deeply punishing to team dynamics.
Face-offs require wingers to remain outside the painted circle until the puck is dropped. If a winger gets overeager, tries to anticipate the drop, and creaks their skate inside the face-off circle too early, a face-off violation is called, the play is blown dead.
But here is the cruel twist of the rulebook. The winger who committed the violation is not the one who gets punished.
No, they are not.
Under NHL, USA Hockey, and the newest IIHF rules, if a winger encroaches into the circle, the center gets thrown out of the face-off dot and replaced by a teammate.
Exactly. The center gets ejected for the winger's lack of discipline. So the center's pre-face-off communication must be incredibly authoritative. They must communicate clearly to their wingers, hold your position, do not cheat, let me win the draw cleanly, do not jump early, and get me kicked out of the dot.
And they need a backup plan, too.
Furthermore, that communication must include contingency planning. The center must pre-plan exactly which winger will take the draw if the center does get tossed.
Because what happens if that replacement winger steps into the dot and another teammate commits a second encroachment violation on the same face-off?
A second face-off violation committed by the same team on the same draw results in a bench minor penalty in the NHL and IIHF. Your team is immediately going on the penalty kill.
Just for jumping the gun twice.
So that second attempt at the face-off must be executed with absolute flawless discipline.
We focus heavily on verbal commands. But what about nonverbal cues? Because sometimes the rink is just too overwhelmingly loud, or you are running a set play that you do not want the opponent to hear.
Nonverbal cues are an essential secondary layer of communication, but they carry distinct risks. Pointing your stick or tapping the blade of your stick loudly on the ice are standard universal signals for, I am open, pass me the puck.
But the source material provides a very strong tactical warning against relying on this, right? All stick taps sound exactly alike.
Exactly. It is auditory camouflage.
So if I'm skating backward with the puck, a smart opposing defender can just tap their stick on the ice right behind me, mimicking my teammate, and I might blindly drop past the puck right onto their tape for a breakaway.
You must never make a blind pass based on a stick tap alone. You must pair the auditory cue with visual confirmation. Specifically, eye contact. Even a tenth of a second of eye contact confirms that the player behind you is actually your teammate and that they are prepared to receive the puck.
Visual confirmation is key.
But the most reliable, elite, nonverbal cue is reading the hips.
Reading the hips. Walk me through the biomechanics of that. What does a player's hip alignment tell me?
The direction a player's feet and hips are pointing dictates their physical trajectory. It tells you exactly what they are about to do before they do it.
Makes sense.
If a teammate is skating down the wing and their hips remain square to the boards, they are signaling that they intend to stay wide. If they suddenly open their hips toward the middle of the ice, they are non-verbally communicating that they are about to cut inside toward the slot.
Wow.
When you watch elite professional players, it looks like they have telepathy. They don't. They are simply operating at a level where they expertly read the physical mechanics of their line mate's hips and anticipate the vector.
That is incredible. Okay, we have covered an immense masterclass level amount of ground today. We have moved from the medical mechanics of the cervical spine to the geometric imaginary planes of the glass, all the way to the psychological warfare of the goalie claiming a shooter.
We really have.
It is time for our final synthesis. How do we tie all these disparate rules and mechanics into a single, cohesive mental framework?
If we synthesize everything we have discussed, the overarching philosophy is this. On-ice communication is not just about making noise. It is the physical, audible bridge that connects the player who can clearly see the future, meaning the impending physical threat or the open patch of ice, with the player who is currently blind but possesses the puck and must act upon it.
The Away ACS plane feeding critical coordinates to the fighter pilot flying blind in the canyon.
Precisely. To truly master this material, you must view the game through the lens of sight, safety, and geometry.
So as a final takeaway, let's weave together the core truths of this framework. For you listening, if you walk away from this conversation remembering nothing else, remember these principles. The entire system begins with the understanding that the puck carrier is blind. Your voice must become their eyes.
And that voice dictates physical safety. The command man on is not a suggestion. It is a biomechanical imperative. It dictates skates parallel to the boards, absorbing the kinetic energy on the hip and forearm, and ensuring the chin remains elevated to prevent catastrophic cervical compression.
Geographically, you must respect the kill zones. You never, under any circumstance, route a pass horizontally through the slot in your own defensive end. And when desperation sets in, you must respect the strict liability of the imaginary vertical plane extending above the glass.
Aiming for the bench will not save you from a delay of game penalty.
Furthermore, you must understand the physical toll of your decisions. Icing the puck at even strength is a cardiovascular trap, as the rulebook expressly forbids line changes or timeouts to rescue your exhausted teammates.
And when defending, you must recognize that legally clearing a screener requires surgical precision boxing out with the hips and lifting the stick solely below the opponent's bottom hand to avoid severe slashing or cross-checking ejections.
Tactically, you must understand the paradigm shift of the goaltender. A goalie screaming shot during an odd man rush is not a warning to flinch. It is a definitive claim of responsibility, commanding the defenseman to completely abandon the shooter and erase the passing lane.
And finally, your understanding of the game's boundaries must be dictated by your specific rulebook. Knowing whether an offside call or a goaltender's red line restriction is measured by the physical contact of the skate blade on the ice, or merely the three-dimensional position of the puck, dictates how aggressively you can transition.
And above all, the vocal execution of these rules must always be early, short, and loud.
Because in the end, the loudest team always gives the illusion of being the most physically skilled team.
This has been an absolute masterclass, but I want to leave you, the listener, with a final provocative thought to mull over. The next time you walk into a freezing local rink, or the next time you sit on your couch and turn on a professional game on television, I want you to try a difficult experiment.
This is a good one.
For one entire shift,
yeah.
45 seconds, force yourself to completely ignore the puck. I know it goes against every human instinct, but do it.
Just watch the players.
Watch the heads of the 9 players who do not have the puck on their stick. Watch how furiously they are scanning the ice, swiveling their necks to map the threats. Watch their gloves pointing at unmarked men. And most importantly, watch their mouths moving, constantly, relentlessly shouting data points across the ice.
If you do that, the illusion of supernatural speed and telepathy fades away, and you will see the hidden, intricate network of verbal information that actually runs the sport.
You will realize that the fastest, most physically violent, most geographically demanding game on Earth isn't actually played with the fiberglass stick in their hands. It is played with the human voice. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time.